Greetings and ululectic morphodontations, my grammometric listeners, and welcome to this April 2017 Science News Update. I'm your host for this peridotedly peculiar science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Welcome, everyone. Let's get some sofa business out of the way first. As you may or may not know, in about 20 weeks or so, Starship SOFA will be celebrating its 500th episode. Tony Smith, founder and chief bottle washer for the operation, has invited me to speak live for that particular episode. This is not the first time that Tony has honored me with such a request, and I have puzzled him in the past by telling him I'm uncomfortable speaking under live conditions like that. Tony responded logically that I speak live to large auditoriums of students for a living, so I should not have a problem with such a presentation. And Tony is correct, but that does not preclude my terror for being recorded live. No, I do not even understand my own psychology. I can't explain it. I spoke to my lovely wife about my dilemma, and she said that I really had an obligation speaking at the 500th episode, since I've been with this thing from the very beginning, and still have bragging rights to the Hugo Award we won a few years back. I have hemmed and hawed about this for the last few days. Finally, this is my public response to Tony. All right? As long as my schedule does not preclude doing the show, or no emergency arises suddenly, I do agree to participate in the live show for the 500th celebration. Although, let it be on your head to ignore the ums and the ohs and the ahs and the various throat clearings that my nervousness may engender. I can hear the guffawing now in podcast land. Lord have mercy on my soul. Let's get to serious business. Here's an article that I came across in the journal The Scientist. I don't usually do this, but I am actually going to read the article in full, because it's one of the funniest things I've ever come across, at least in a science journal. You may remember that I have mentioned predatory journals from time to time. These are journals that try to take advantage of scientific authors. I constantly get email from these folks trying to get me to write papers way outside my specialty, usually having something to do with cardiology or epidemiology or some such nonsense. These journals have almost no review process, and then they ask authors for massive payments to publish work in their useless, unqualified journals. Well, Dr. John H. McCool of Houston, Texas, yes, that is his real name, decided to do something about the bane of fake journals. McCool is the founder and senior scientific editor of Precision Scientific Editing, which aids authors in writing papers for journals. He decided to troll the dirty rats in the most academic way possible. Here's the text of his article. I'm not a physician, much less a urologist, but I am an editor of scientific writing who has a strong antipathy for predatory journals. I'm also a Seinfeld fanatic. So I decided to troll this publication, the MedCrave Group's Urology and Nephrology Open Access Journal, to see whether they would agree to publish a totally made-up, Seinfeld-themed case report about a man who develops uromycetitis poisoning. This was inspired by the classic 1991 episode, The Parking Garage, in which Jerry Seinfeld can't find his car in a mall lot and has to urinate, and does so against a garage wall, and is caught by a security guard and tries to get out of a citation by claiming that he suffers from a condition called uromycetitis. Seinfeld argued that due to his illness, he would die if he doesn't relieve himself whenever he needs to. I went all out. I wrote my report as Dr. Martin Van Nostrum, the physician alter ego of another Seinfeld character, and listed more show-inspired names as bogus co-authors. I made an email account for Dr. Van Nostrum and created a false institution where the authors worked, the Arthur Vandelay Urological Research Institute. In the acknowledgement section of my report, I thanked phony physicians, including Tor Ekman, the bizarre holistic healer from The Heart Attack, giving him a Doctor of Holistic Medicine, HMD degree, So basically, I wrote the manuscript in a style as close to a real case report as I could, except that it was 100% fake. To my surprise, a representative at the Urology Journal wrote to say that my manuscript was sent out for peer review. 3 days later, it was conditionally accepted. I was asked to make minor revisions, including trimming the abstract and including the phony patient's lab results, and pay a nominal $799 fee plus tax. Editor's note, it usually takes a minimum of a month for manuscripts to get reviewed. I have had papers in initial review for up to 5 months. Back to the story. Continuing to dupe the publication, I did all that was asked, except remit payment. And on March 31st, my report was published on the journal's website. I have no intention of paying the requested fee. A simple Google search for uromycetitis or Martin Van Nostrum returns thousands of references to Seinfeld. Checking just one of the papers I included in the manuscript's reference section, the editors or reviewers could easily have determined that it was fabricated. Why did the journal publish a report so easily identifiable as fake? I'll leave that one to the publication to explain. Why, you might ask, did I take this stunt as far as I did? For the last year, I've been on a personal crusade against fake scientific journals, and I have written several articles on the topic. In 2016, I was invited to submit a paper to the Journal of Nanomedicine Research, also published by MedCrave. I posted an article on LinkedIn about this, but it was not widely read, nor effective at exposing the journal as dubious. So when the Urology Journal came calling, I thought a more extreme trolling operation might be more effective. I wrote the fictitious case report over a weekend. My short-term goal is to expose MedCrave as a publisher that will print fiction for a price. My long-term goal, an ambitious one I know, is to stop the production of predatory journals altogether. Okay, let's go from the amazing to the absurd with the President of the United States. I predicted this last month, but it has come to pass. As anticipated, President Trump's budget proposal includes substantial cuts at federal research agencies, including the U.S. National Institutes of Health, NIH, and the Environmental Protection Agency. If approved by Congress, the budget would enact cuts of $5.8 billion at NIH, nearly 19% of the agency's current budget, and more than $2.6 billion from the EPA, which is around 31% of that agency's current allotment. Okay, mind you, I am a supporter of smaller government, but I feel like cutting NIH's budget is like, well, cutting your nose off despite your face. It's going to do nothing but hurt you in the long run, and it is just plain stupid. Dr. Benjamin Korb, Director of Public Affairs at the American Society for Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, publicly made the following statement about the president's budget. Quote, "A $6 billion cut to NIH is unacceptable to the scientific community and should be unacceptable to the American public as well. President Donald Trump's fiscal year 2018 spending plan erases years' worth of bipartisan support for the NIH and the American Biomedical Research Enterprise, which has long been the global leader for biomedical innovation. Cuts this deep threaten America's ability to remain a leader in medicine." Unquote. I worry less about being a leader in world health research than I do about the long-term worldwide problems that may arise from the NIH and the CDC cutting back on their research work. It's kind of chilling. I guess even the president realized that the CDC is important because the Washington Post reports that his budget does include a $500 million block grant to support states' public health responses. It's not entirely clear, but this funding may be meant to replace the CDC's existing Prevention and Public Health Fund, which would disappear if Obamacare was ever completely abolished. If the loss of public health protection from the CDC depresses you, well, here's an antidote, maybe. Dr. Albin Gauthier, researcher at the UVA School of Medicine, just published a paper that suggests your emotional well-being might be modified by eating yogurt, which in turn would affect your microbiome, which might pull you out of your depression. The paper was published in Scientific Reports, and it's entitled Microbiota Alteration is Associated with the Development of Stress-Induced Despair Behavior. Gaudier says, quote, "Depression is one of the most common mental health conditions in the United States, with up to 7% of people experiencing a major depressive episode. It's a huge problem, and the treatments are not very good because they come with huge side effects," unquote. While many scientists have long held that the gut microbiome has a major influence on many body systems, including the brain, it has only been in recent years that many of the underlying molecular mechanisms have been explained. In that vein, Gaudier set out to see if they could find a concrete link between, well, depression and gut health. Gaudier and his team looked at the composition of the gut microbiome before and after mice were subjected to stress. And he found that the major change was the loss of lactobacillus. With the loss of the bacterial genus came the onset of depression symptoms. Here's the amazing result. If you feed the mice lactobacillus with their food, they returned to almost normal and no longer appeared to be depressed. Gaudier wanted to determine the mechanism by which lactobacillus influences depression. He found that the amount of lactobacillus in the gut affects the level of a metabolite in the blood called kynurenine. This particular metabolite has been shown to drive depression. When lactobacillus was diminished in the gut, the levels of kynurenine increased, presumably causing the depression symptoms to set in. While Gaudier and his team are excited about their findings, they urge caution about overinterpretation of the results. Remember that a depressed mouse is not a depressed human, and how exactly do you know if the mouse is truly and actually depressed? Can a mouse actually be in despair? Mice have no way to communicate that they are feeling depressed. Unfortunately, for good or bad, those symptoms are widely accepted as the best available model, though, for looking at depression in creatures other than humans. Yet, based on their findings, the investigators are looking to begin studying the effect in people as soon as possible. The researchers intend to examine the effects of lactobacillus on depression in patients with multiple sclerosis, a group in which the disorder is common. And additionally, Gaudier and his team are continuing to try to better understand the role of kynurenine in depression onset and within the gut microbiota. All right, let's try a topic which is less depressing. How about water bears? The world knows no toughness like that of the water bear. This microscopic critter can survive boiling water, some of the lowest temperatures in the universe, and blasts of radiation that would kill a human. So what makes these little buggers so tough? Well, we think we now know. In a paper out last month in the journal Molecular Cell, Dr. Thomas C. Boothby of the University of North Carolina and his colleagues claim that they have found an exclusively tardigradian protein that the water bear produces, forming it into a glass bead. It's in this state that the water bear can pull off such extreme feats of survival, which might be very convenient for human medicine one day. Boothby looked closely at the genes that turned on as water bears dried out in hopes of figuring out which genes were responsible for its survival. At the top of the list were a series of switched-on genes which are called intrinsically disordered proteins. Intrinsically disordered proteins are those amino acid chains that don't have a nice, neat 3D structure like most other proteins. So they act in a strange and kind of loose manner without any defined structure. Boothby has pinpointed the genes that make the water bear's life-saving proteins. He says, quote, "We went on to show that if you reduce expression of these genes in tardigrades, they can no longer survive desiccation very well. If you take those genes and put them into organisms like bacteria and yeast, which normally don't have them, they actually become much more desiccation tolerant," unquote. The water bear's secret ingredient can make other organisms up to 100 times hardier to desiccation. The protective mechanism of these intrinsically disordered proteins looks like something out of Star Wars. You remember carbonite? That's the material that Han Solo was frozen into by Darth Vader in The Empire Strikes Back. Well, the protective protein found by Boothby turns the water bear into a frozen glass figurine in a process known as vitrification, a la Han Solo in carbonite. Normally, desiccation crystallizes living cells, shredding up proteins and DNA in the process. But with the gentler, smoother process of vitrification, the water bear can ride out the desiccation, only to reanimate once it hits water up to 30 years later. Do I hear gasps out there? 30 years? Yes, 30 years. Could we have found a protein that may allow us to travel to the outer planets of the solar system, or even the stars? Is hypersleep possible that would suspend all life until de-vitrification? Well, apparently it is for the water bear, but we need to have lots more understanding of this protein to use it anywhere else. However, Boothby is already suggesting more prosaic uses for the water bear protein. Vaccines, for example, are extremely fragile, requiring refrigeration as doctors ship them around the world. Refrigeration, of course, costs a lot of money and means the vaccines are easily degraded if they're no longer refrigerated. Boothby says, quote, "One potential application would be to use these tardigrade proteins to stabilize vaccines or pharmaceuticals in a dry state that you can keep at room temperature and not have to worry about refrigeration during transport and storage." Unquote. Onward and upward, from the bizarre to the more bizarre. Doctors Teresa Woodruff and Jeffrey Borenstein at Northwestern University have invented something that falls into the 1984/Brave New World creepy part of the spectrum. They've produced an organ-on-a-chip model of the female reproductive system that can mimic the human menstrual cycle. Woodruff and Borenstein named this thing Evatar and told the world about it in the March 28th issue of the journal Nature Communications. Evatar is a chip about the size of a human hand that contains 5 mini organs: a uterus, a vagina, liver, ovaries, and fallopian tubes. All the tissues come from humans, except the ovaries, which were taken from mice, since they're rarely removed from humans. Each organ sits in its own compartment, which is linked to the others through minuscule tubes that carry blood-like liquid and hormones. To mimic the 28-day menstrual cycle on the chip, the team first added follicle-stimulating hormone, then luteinizing hormone 14 days later. This successfully stimulated the ovaries to produce estrogen and progesterone and release an egg. Woodruff says, quote, "This is the first time we've been able to model the entire reproductive hormone profile. You might be able to look at two of these tissues together in culture, but all five together for a month? Well, that's unheard of." Unquote. The team hopes to use Evatar to both better understand the human reproductive system and to test new drugs. Borenstein asks and answers the rhetorical question, quote, "Could it potentially be better than an animal model?" "Yes, because you're using human cells." Unquote. Woodruff and Borenstein now aim to build personalized Evatars using patient-derived stem cells. The team is also working on a male version of the reproductive system on a chip called Adatar, which they hope to release later this year. Okay, let's pull back from the bizarre for a moment to the more practical side of life. So far, I have been follically blessed. Well, sort of. My hair went prematurely gray about 10 years ago, but I blame that mainly on my children. However, I have so far kept a pretty full head of hair, knock on wood. If I live long enough to hit 80, I'm less likely to have much hair on my head, statistically. Male pattern baldness affects about 80% of men by the age of 80. Anyway, baldness can pose psychosocial problems, and even indicate dangerous conditions like prostate cancer. Although researchers have traced male pattern baldness to broad genetic sources, they have only found a handful of genes responsible for this complex trait so far due to, well, small sample sizes. Now, in the largest genomic study of baldness to date, researchers led by Dr. Riccardo Marioni at the University of Edinburgh have pinpointed over 200 genetic regions associated with this common condition. The paper was published last month in PLOS Genetics. Marioni says, quote, "The biggest genetic effect we saw came from the X chromosome, which men inherit from their mothers. However, there are also many genes linked to hair loss that come from the other chromosomes. It's therefore difficult to blame one parent in particular." Unquote. That's what I always tell my genetics classes. Marioni's team split data from 52,000 male participants in the UK Biobank into a discovery sample of 40,000 and a target sample of 12,000 for their genome-wide association study. They then developed a formula to predict a man's chance of baldness based on certain markers, differentiating those with severe hair loss from those with no loss. Because the 287 identified genetic regions mostly contribute to hair structure and growth, they could suggest drug targets for treating hair loss. Future studies that collect the age of hair loss onset may also enable researchers to predict the age at which a man becomes bald. Marioni finishes with, quote, "The prediction aspect of our paper might be useful to stratify men into high-low risk groups to see, for example, who would benefit most from clinical trials of new potential treatments." Unquote. Now, if you want to live a long time, the next story may interest you, although you may be bald if you live that long, but whatever. Caffeine and tea and coffee may help you to live longer by reducing inflammation in your tissues. In a study published in the journal Nature Medicine, Dr. David Furman of Stanford University reports a genetic mechanism responsible for triggering chronic inflammation and the subsequent development of age-related cardiovascular disease. The findings also highlight the role of caffeine consumption in helping to disrupt this inflammatory gene activity in some older adults. Furman states, quote, "Chronic inflammation is a common denominator for almost all diseases of aging, such as hypertension, cancer, and many neurological disorders. Here, we found that some gene networks that normally participate in response to infections are also those that mediate chronic inflammation during aging. We also learned that caffeine plays an important role here, and the effect can be pretty dramatic." Unquote. During an 8-year study, Furman and his team analyzed survey data, blood samples, and medical histories from 100 human participants, a group of adults between the ages of 20 and 30, and another group of adults over 60 in age. By comparing gene expression data between the two groups, Furman's team identified two highly active gene networks in the older age group linked to the production of a powerful inflammatory protein called IL-1-beta. Of the older age group, nearly half demonstrated high levels of IL-1-beta, as well as high levels of nucleic acid metabolites found to boost inflammatory gene activity and production of IL-1-beta. The team also observed that the metabolites caused systemic inflammation and high blood pressure when injected into mice. Furman explains that, quote, "Most of the participants with high activity in these inflammatory gene networks were also hypertensive or suffering from arterial stiffness. Using metabolomic data, we found that one of the metabolites that was high in the inflamed participants was adenine. In our in vitro studies, caffeine was a big adenine antagonist, so we asked what their caffeine intake was like." Unquote. Furman's lab further incubated immune cells with the metabolites along with caffeine compounds, and they found that the caffeine blocked the inflammatory effects of the metabolites in the cells. They found that the effect was pretty big, too. They considered the effect of coffee in milligrams per week, and apparently the effect is linear and surprisingly high for those having 4 to 5 cups of coffee a day. Furman is expanding the team's study to 1,000 participants to explore inflammatory networks that explain other diseases beyond cardiovascular disorders. For now, however, Furman cautions that increasing coffee intake does not by any means guarantee a long life. He says, quote, "Human biology is complicated, and there are a zillion different pathways that can trigger inflammation. Drinking coffee may help in some cases, but generally things are much more complicated than that," unquote. And now for something completely different. Mars! The Martian atmosphere definitely had more gas in the past. How do we know this? Dr. Bruce Chakosky of the University of Colorado and his colleagues have measured and compared the abundances of two isotopes of argon at different altitudes of the Martian atmosphere, and they published their results in Science in the last couple of weeks. Data analyzed from NASA's MAVEN spacecraft by Chakosky indicated that the red planet has lost most of the gas that ever existed in its atmosphere. The results, published in the March 31st journal Science, are the first to quantify how much gas has been lost with time, and they offer clues to how Mars went from a warm, wet place to a cold, dry one. Mars is constantly bombarded by charged particles streaming from the sun. Without a protective magnetic field to deflect the solar wind, the planet loses about 100 grams of its now very thin atmosphere every second. To determine how much atmosphere has been lost during the planet's lifetime, Chakosky employed the abundances of those isotopes of argon and estimates that about 2/3 of all of Mars's argon gas has been ejected into space. Extrapolating from the argon data, Chakosky has also determined that the majority of carbon dioxide that the Martian atmosphere ever had was also kicked into space by the solar wind. The paper suggests that a thicker atmosphere filled with carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases could have insulated Mars early on and kept it warm enough for liquid water and maybe even life. Losing an extreme amount of gas, as the results suggest, may explain how the planet morphed from that lush and wet system to the barren and icy one that we know of now. All right, let's finish this evening with some actual good news, for those of us in the U.S. at least. We can certainly use some lately, can't we? On World Cancer Day, February 4th this year, the American Cancer Society released its annual Cancer Facts and Figures Report, a detailed study of population-based cancer incidence and mortality in the U.S. that teases apart trends across cancer types and demographics. Dr. Rebecca Siegel, the team leader of the report, stated in an interview, quote, "We found that the cancer death rate is continuing to decline and has in fact dropped by about 25% in the past couple of decades," unquote. Using national data from 1999 to 2013 to build a mathematical model of mortality, the ACS researchers predicted that nearly 601,000 Americans will die from cancer in 2017, a daily average of about 1,650, with the most common causes being lung, colorectal, prostate, and breast cancer. However, the team also estimated that around 659,000 cancer deaths in women and about 1.4 million in men have been averted since 1991, due to declines in the death rate. The report suggests that the decreases may be the result of improving treatment regimens or reductions in behavioral risk factors. For example, rates of blood cancer and lymphoma survival have been boosted by the advent of precision medicine in recent years, and the decrease in incidence and death rate for lung cancer, a disease that now has an 18% 5-year survival rate, probably has smoking cessation campaigns and the overall decrease in the cigarette's popularity to thank. Rates of cancer screening also play an important role in driving trends in both incidence and mortality. For example, the declines in colorectal cancer incidence, down 3% per year from 2004 to 2013, and death rate probably reflect improvements in early detection. The chief reason? Well, the report points out that colonoscopy use in adults over the age of 50 has tripled since 2000. So polyps are detected and taken out before they have the opportunity to progress to cancer. Unfortunately, despite overall declines in cancer, not all types of cancer follow the trend, and an important purpose of the ACS report is to identify areas that need more attention. For example, this year's report highlights that some cancers, like liver cancer, are increasing. And so that's an area that needs additional research. Liver cancer incidence rose by 3% per year in women and 4% per year in men from 2004 to 2013, while the death rate in both sexes climbed by almost 3% per year from 2010 to 2014. Unfortunately, there is a disparity in cancer incidence and cures if you look at the details of the data. For example, men have a 20% overall higher incidence of cancer than women, and their mortality rate is 40% higher. This gender imbalance isn't really understood at all. The disparities among different ethnicities are similarly striking. The data reveals that both cancer incidence and death rates are highest in Black populations and lowest in Asian Americans. Worse, Black Americans are also more likely than whites to be diagnosed with cancer once it's reached an advanced stage and have lower survival rates at each stage of the cancer progression. Siegel says, quote, "The gap in the races is closing up. Around 1990, overall cancer death rate in Black men was almost 50% higher than it was in white men. That rate has now dropped to only about 20% higher today. The decrease has been only slightly less dramatic in Black women, falling from 20% higher in white women to 13% between 1998 and 2014. Siegel points out that there are several factors that contribute to this trend of closing the gap between the races. She says, quote, "One factor includes substantial declines in smoking among Black teenagers of the 1970s and recent improvements in access to treatment. Also, from 2010 to 2015, there's been a drop by half in the proportion of Black people in the U.S. who do not have health insurance coverage. That's huge, huge progress," unquote. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care, pray for the NIH, drink that coffee, eat that yogurt, keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.